Mr. Condren, reel four.
Well, he gathered us around him in a little group, as I said, I don't know, 30 or 40 of us, and proceeded to give us this little speech. I can't remember his exact words, I can only paraphrase. But it was something to the effect that we were not his real enemies, that the real enemies were the imperialists, the American imperialists, and that we had been sent over thousands of miles of ocean to Korea to kill innocent men and innocent women and children, but that we weren't to blame, that in actual fact that we were, he was a proletarian and we were proletarians, and his real argument wasn't with us. And personally speaking, I wasn't quite sure at the time what an imperialist was or what a proletarian was, and I remember a chap next to me turning around and said, "Proly what?" he said. He said, "I thought they were bloody communists." That was the sort of level of a thinker. Anyway, this little speech he gave us lasted about, I suppose, about 10 minutes, but none of us could really understand what he was saying, but at least they seemed, you know, they weren't shooting us or treating us very harshly or anything. Anyway, he finally wandered away, and they finally formed us up, and we marched off, and we walked off up a hillside, up to a few huts. So there were still a lot of huts and everything around burning and so on. And took us up there, and then they ushered us into this little hut. And we'd been in there for, I suppose, about an hour or so, sort of not knowing what was going to happen or what. And after a little while, one of the guards, one of the Chinese guards, came to the door. And as you probably know, in Korea, they don't use much glass. They cover the doors with paper. It's a kind of framework. They just put paper, greaseproof paper or newspaper or anything. But most of that had been blown out of this particular door. Anyway, this Chinese guard came up, and he had a very, very large gourd, probably about a couple of feet across, and it was filled with steaming hot water, you see. So he said something to us in Chinese, none of us could understand, of course, and he put this water inside the door, and off he went. So we all looked at one another, and we presumed that it was very kind, and proceeded to wash up, and as you see, you know, a few people had bars of soap. You tend to carry lots of things when you're in action. And we proceeded to wash up. Well, it must have been, as I say, about 20 or 30 of them. And by the time we finished, this water was pretty soapy and muddy and dirty looking. And after a little while, the same guard came back, and he opened the door, and he took one look at this water. And then I think he just went mad. His face went red and his eyes stuck out, and he pulled this rifle and bayonet off his shoulder. It was one of these very long bayonets, a couple of feet long. And he leapt into the room swinging this bayonet about, and we were all pushed back against the walls. We didn't know what had happened. And he lashed around. Luckily, it didn't hit anyone, but was really annoyed. And he said something, I don't know, seemed to be cursing us out. And he finally swung his heel and he kicked this gourd of water out of the way, and he just stomped off, you see. Well, again, we just didn't know what this was all about. We thought the poor chap had just gone crackers, you know. And a short time after that, the same little officer came up that had spoken to us initially. And he came in pretty angry as well. And he explained to us that this guard, at considerable risk to himself, had built a fire, because if you have a fire, you have smoke, and if you have smoke, it attracts aircraft, and at that time, there was only American aircraft around, and, you know. Anyway, he had lit this fire, and he had boiled this water up for us to drink. And we, of course, had washed up in it. So this was, as he saw it, a great insult to the guard, and a great slight, because he had tried to help us out by giving us hot water to drink. But no one had ever explained to us that the Koreans or the Chinese specifically only drink boiled water. They don't drink cold water. And in fact, it's one of the staples of the peasants in China is hot water. In some places they call it tea, and it's only hot water. So we tried to explain our point of view to him, but he really wouldn't listen. The only thing I'd ever used hot water for was to bathe in or to wash in. I'd never drank hot water in my life on its own. We tried to explain it, but he still didn't believe us, and he thought that we were deliberately slighting the guard. And of course, again, seeing it in retrospect, you see, the guard had lost face. We had made him lose face because he had tried to do something decent for us, and we had spurned him, in his mind, deliberately, but in our minds, no. It was a very strange way, or in a strange way, it was sort of East meets West. And that's later on, I often saw it as a sort of the acme of this point, you know, where it's total misunderstanding and ignorance on both sides. And no harm is intended, but the net result is that both sides misunderstand one another and are angry at one another. And although I didn't see it at that particular point in time in that way, it was to me later on a sort of evident lesson in the ignorance between East and West and just ordinary ways of living and habits of living and things like that.
Was the guard Chinese or not?
The guard
Korean?
Was Chinese. He was Chinese, yes. So that was sort of my introduction to it, and after that, they came round, and people who were badly wounded, they took away and said they were going to send them back to our own lines. And we heard later on that everyone who, well, most of the people who didn't die of the wounds had been sent back. They put them in jeeps and lorries, and they sent them back to our own lines, all the wounded. There were a few of the chaps who had sort of superficial wounds, and there was a couple of our Marines, because we said to them, well, why don't you go and join them? He said, no, we'll just stay with you guys, because they thought that there might be a limitation in the numbers of people they'd allow to go. As far as I know, there wasn't, but a couple of our lads who'd been wounded superficially stayed. And later on, of course, they died. Anyone who was wounded died, because we had no medical treatment, nothing later on.
Were they sending all wounded back, or just the seriously wounded?
Well, it was basically the seriously wounded. But there were a number of people who went with the wounded who, I mean, what is a serious wound? It's a relative term. Probably if you have a superficial wound, you consider it rather serious, for other people might not. But there were a number of people joined that group who, by my reckoning, were superficially wounded. But as I say, it was probably better for them in the long run, because people who consider themselves superficially wounded later died as a result of those wounds, because there was no medical attention. Of course, at that time, we didn't know there was going to be no medical attention. We hadn't a clue what was going to happen to us. Another thing, we stayed there 2 or 3 days. Another thing they did is they searched us, and we had to line up, and they proceeded to take, as I say, weapons and grenades and so on had been taken away from us, but they did search us individually, and we had to line up at a couple of little tables, and they took away from us such things as knives and things like that. I had a steel mirror in one of my pockets, and they took that, but they gave us, in most cases, they gave us a little explanation as to why they were taking things. Knives, obvious, you know, like, you know, you carry pocket knives and not bayonet-type knives, or something, it was pocket knives, something like that. And I remember him telling me that he was taking my steel mirror because I could use it to signal the planes. And while I was queuing up, actually, I noticed they were also taking cigarette lighters. And I had a big Ronson lighter, which I'd been given for my 21st birthday, as a matter of fact, about a year before. And I thought, well, there's no way they're going to get this cigarette lighter from me. because it had obvious sentimental value. And then I wondered, well, where I could hide it, because I saw they weren't searching people with great deliberation. It was a fairly easygoing search, just patting pockets and things. And I thought, well, where shall I hide it? And then I remembered that I had American sort of field trousers on over my British Army battle dress. And as you know, in the British Army battle dress, we used to have a map pocket, I think, on the left thigh here, or sometimes it was at the side. So I very quickly put this lighter down into the big map pocket and waited. And when he came to search me, of course, he didn't find it, because he's looking for pockets in American uniforms and didn't think of being a pocket there. So I kept my lighter. In fact, I still had it up until a few years ago. Finally, it was no longer in working condition. I think I disposed of it. But later on in the camp, well, particularly the early days, it was pretty useful, because we could usually get a light when we wanted it, if we needed it. Finally ran out of petrol. I just used to tie a bit of string around it and drop it in a tank of petrol of some truck or something if I could. And then eventually ran out of petrol. I had a couple of spare flints. You could spark the flint into cotton and blow on it and eventually get a light. So, as I say, they did, on the whole, give explanations. They took watches as well. And the people in our group, anyway, that took the watches from were all given a receipt. And they were told that the watches would be returned to them. Well, this is a joke. Nobody believed it. But strangely enough, about a year later, when I was in the prisoner of war camp, most of the chaps got the watches back. They returned to them. It struck me as rather strange at the time, but that's what actually happened. From there, after a few days after that, we started off. They took us sort of on a long march. I don't know, we must have marched for about 3 weeks. Further and further north, further and further into the mountains. Very deep snow, very, very cold. Mostly on sort of unbeaten tracks up and down the mountains.
Were you under Allied attack?
Not all the time. We were occasionally strafed and attacked from the air. But not very often, because we could only move at night. And they told us we could only move at night because of air activity during the day. You see, at that time, the Chinese, all the North Koreans, had no planes in the air. So the Allied forces, or the Americans, had total air supremacy and could do anything they liked in the air. And they were more or less strafing, bombing or dropping napalm on anything that moved. And I was told this later by an American pilot who was captured. And he said at that time their orders were anything that moved. And they were also given instructions to destroy any building that looked like it could be used as a warehouse to store grain or food supplies. So North Korea at that time was virtually flattened. There wasn't very much around.
How were you treated on this march?
Surprisingly, fairly well. Well, one had to put up with the elements, the cold and so on, because you never really got very warm. And I suppose we covered, I don't know, something like 5 to 10 miles each night. We weren't going very far. But a lot of the time it was through fairly thick snow, and, you know, it wasn't always easy going, sometimes over fairly small mountain tracks and paths. We were never maltreated or harshly treated. Some of the chaps who were wounded had difficulty, and they tended sometimes to fall behind the line. There must have been in all about a couple of hundred of us at this time. Mostly American Marines, some American Army chaps, and again about, I can't remember, about 20-odd of British commandos. We tended to stick together as a group and try to, you know, try to keep together and help one another.
What happened to the stragglers?
We carried ours. We carried ours, and But I'm sad to say that sometimes Americans left them to struggle. They weren't too keen on helping them. Not in every case, but in some cases. American Marines were better. We made a point of taking it in turn when two or three of our chaps who were badly wounded and couldn't manage, we took it in turn to carry them. And we actually carried them on our backs, you know, for carry them for a mile, and someone else would take over and carry them. We had nothing we could make stretchers of or anything at all. You just had what you stood up in actual fact.
So what happened to the
On several occasions, a few days or a week or so into the march, the Chinese did provide kind of ox carts, which brought up the rear, and the badly wounded were put in the ox carts. You know. But the trouble of sitting in the ox cart was you then froze. At least if you were walking, you were keeping fairly warm. So it was a bit difficult. But as I say, I think almost all, to my knowledge, of people who were wounded actually died. You had to be very, very lucky to survive. And when I say no medicine, I mean no medicine. There wasn't even aspirins or sticking plaster. There was nothing. But as far as we could see at the time, the Chinese didn't have anything for themselves either. So that was the situation.
Did they have any medical personnel with them?
I think they had, but they didn't really attend to us. As far as I remember, you know, there may have been cases where they bandaged people up. In fact, I think there probably was, but I don't personally recall having seen it. And as a matter of fact, it was on that march that it was the only time that I was ever physically maltreated. You see, on the march, you would, as I say, maybe you'd go 5, 10, 12 miles a night. And as you moved into different areas, you were then taken over by, I suppose, different companies. You know, probably the guards with us were probably about company strength, thereabouts. And as you moved into areas, sometimes we were taken over by North Koreans. And then you'd gone a bit and you were taken over by Chinese and then maybe by North Koreans again. It was mainly Chinese, but it was occasionally we were actually under North Koreans.
How could you tell them apart?
Different uniforms. You knew who was Chinese and who was Korean. And it was on one night, must have been very early in the morning, maybe, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the morning or something, because we had always to get to our destination before dawn broke and get undercover before it got light. And we were marching along, and it was one of these roads that run around the side of a mountain. You know, you sort of had a rather deep precipice on the left-hand side. And everything white, snow. And as we were marching along, or walking along, or straggling along, there was some American aircraft came over, and they dropped flares. And not directly above us, but nearby. And the guards got a bit panicky, so they hurried, they made everyone sort of go at the double, and they moved them up. It's a sort of jog trot, because some distance ahead of it, the mountainside shelved in, and they got them undercover there, where they wouldn't be seen from the air. Unfortunately, I'd fallen behind, I don't know, 100 yards or so, because I was carrying one of our chaps on my back at the time. He'd been wounded. I couldn't keep up with the main body. I was trying to run, but I obviously was handicapped to some extent. And this Korean, North Korean, he came running back. He's only a short fellow, but his rifle and bayonet looked taller than he was. And he started screaming at me in Japanese, you know, haba haba, which means, you know, to hurry up. The only sort of way we had to be in contact with the Koreans was just Japanese, a few words of Japanese that we had picked up around. So he shouted and screamed at me to hubba hubba, you see. And he started prodding me with his bayonet. Didn't inflict any damage. It didn't get through my clothes. It just, you know, and he smacked me a few times with his rifle butt to hurry up. And again, I got a bit angry and I expressed my anger. But the chap I was carrying on my back, he said, "No, it's okay, it's okay." He said, He's trying to get us undercover, actually, you know, because of the aircraft. He said, "Never mind, you know," because I was about ready to have a go at it. Anyway, we finally got up there and we got undercover, and the planes dropped a few more flares and they dropped some bombs further away from us, and then they moved away. So it was okay. But that was the only occasion that I was ever physically maltreated. And although I was annoyed at the time, again looking back in it, I can see that, well, I could understand the reasons for it, because had they seen me, they might have bombed the place and many people might have been killed or injured.
When you first came across the Chinese and North Koreans, was it an eye-opener in any way? Was it a surprise? Were there any surprises in store, apart from the misunderstanding you've already described?
Well, initially we were quite surprised because they seemed very ill-equipped, and they didn't seem to have any real protective clothing. A lot of them were just wearing kind of rubber tennis shoes, sort of thing, and some of them were in light uniforms. Most of them were in padded uniforms, but the uniforms were rather dirty and had been torn up. I don't know, they must have been in action with them or something, but they were very poorly equipped. In fact, most of the weapons, they carried some antiquated weapons on occasions, but most of them were carrying American M1s and carbines. They armed themselves with American weapons, it seemed, mostly. I had the feeling that if they had come to Korea with some equipment, it wasn't very good equipment. And they had got most of the equipment from, well, what they captured.
What antiquated weapons, specifically?
Some very old rifles.
You mean Second World War vintage?
Second World War. Some, I think, might even have been First World War. They had some really weird-looking rifles. Shortly Enfields they had, of course, which were, I think a First World War weapon, shortly Enfields, we should. But they were quite a good weapon. I mean, most of the British Army had them in the Second World War, at the beginning, certainly.
Did they have Russian weapons?
Yes, burp guns. They had burp guns, you know, with a cylindrical drum. Especially North Koreans. North Koreans had them. Well, Chinese too, but it seemed the North Koreans, it seemed just about every Korean had a burp gun. The Mauser was quite a common weapon. Most of the Chinese officers carried, again, First World War Mausers with a big wooden holster, which you could take off and use as a butt. That was one thing that surprised me. Another thing that surprised me, gradually, not at first, but the fact that they were quite friendly. And on the march itself, sometimes you'd pause for a break and you'd sort of crouch down or sit down in the snow, and you'd see one of the Chinese light up a cigarette, and of course we'd all be looking at them, and very often they'd come up and they'd give you the cigarette, which you'd then share out. Or sometimes they'd come and give you a pack, or what was left in a pack of 10, and they'd just give it to you. And they seemed quite cheerful and quite friendly. Obviously we couldn't communicate outside of a few words of Japanese. The Chinese on the whole seemed better, which perhaps understandably, because it was the North Koreans, it was their country that was being flattened, and they probably, I don't know, but they probably saw us as being partially responsible. They weren't quite so friendly, but the Chinese on the whole were quite friendly and quite cheerful. And another thing that surprised me on the march is, I say that they traveled, the guards that we had were, I don't know, probably company strength. And the Chinese companies tended to carry all the weapons with them. They had no transport, okay? And they carried they had their own heavy weapons section. They carried these huge, I think, 2-inch mortars with a rather heavy plate, base plate. One of them would be carrying the actual mortar, the other would be carrying the base plate. They also carried their own very large cooking pots. Very large cooking pots, probably about 3 or 4 feet across, like a big wok. And it was sometimes quite amusing when you looked ahead and you'd see these Chinese sort of going up the mountainside and with this large pot on the back, and it looked like a big black turtle moving up the hillside. And this amused us at first, because we thought, we used to talk amongst ourselves, and we used to say that had the positions been reversed, you know, that they were the prisoners and that they would carry our heavy stuff, we'd make the prisoners carry. But they didn't. They didn't make us carry anything at all. We carried what we stood in, unless you were carrying a wounded man. That struck me as rather odd, but then the conclusion we came to, well, they're probably just stupid peasants anyway, and they don't, you know, understand these other things. But that impressed me. We finally got to a little village, which I think later on was known as Camp Number 10. But it wasn't really a camp or anything at all. It was just a village somewhere in the mountains with little huts and houses here and there. The Korean huts, mostly just they're made of mud and wattle with paper windows, as you may know, tiled roofs. And we were just distributed among various huts, 10 here, 20 here, and 15 there, and so on. And we stayed there for 2 or 3 months. Another thing that I remember struck me is, because we had to stay in these huts all day. We weren't allowed out during the day or from sunup to sundown. We were allowed out in the morning for about 50 minutes or half an hour before it got light for a bit of exercise, to run up and down, walk up and down. And again in the evening when it got dark. Aside from that, we were constricted to the actual hut, the room that we were in. In most cases, there was no form of heating in the huts. One or two, there might have been, well, there were still Koreans living in the rooms next door, because they have a kind of underfloor heating system, which is basically the old Roman system of tunnels and so on underneath the ground. But on the whole, there wasn't much heating. It was just mud floors, straw on the floor. The particular little hut that I was in had about a hole about 2 feet across from one corner that obviously had been damaged in bombing or something, but the wind used to haul through there, and we had no paper on the doors. It was mostly all blown out, so the wind used to haul through, and it got pretty uncomfortable. But you didn't take your clothes off, of course. We just used to huddle together to try and keep warm. We couldn't wash. We didn't wash for, well, a good 3 months, if not more. The only thing you could do is you took a bit of snow and rubbed it on the palms of your hands, and the palms of your hands you tried to keep clean. But other than that, you couldn't wash. You couldn't take clothes off.
Did you suffer because of the lack of cleanliness?
Oh, yeah. Within a very short space of time, we all had lice. I've had lice, crabs, and bed bugs at night, all at the same time. Some medical opinion has it that bed bugs and lice don't coexist. I can tell you they do. They do. But the bed bugs only hit you at night. And most of the Korean houses seem to be stricken with bed bugs. They were just in the walls and everything. And lice, I suppose, just came through lack of cleanliness. I don't know how they breed or where they initially come from. But after a month or two, you sort of just got used to it, and you just sort of shrugged and you itched. Everybody was the same. You just scratched. Occasionally, you'd very quickly take your outer garments off and get a sweater off, and then put your outer garments back on, you de-louse the sweater. And of course, all up the seams, there were eggs, and there was just lice all over it. And I recall one day sitting there and